A military order originally established in Palestine in the 11th century to tend sick pilgrims, the Knights of St. John had been evicted with the last of the Crusaders from the Holy Land in 1291. After a long search for a suitable new headquarters, followed by a two-year siege, they had captured Rhodes, which in 1310 they had made their base, and which, by a subsequent papal decree, became their property. In these circumstances, they were not only an order of knighthood, they were a sovereign state. One of their very first tasks on their arrival had been to start work on their new infirmary. It was soon to become the most celebrated, and by far the best, hospital in the world. The Great Ward, which remains today almost exactly as it was when the order left it nearly five centuries ago, could accommodate no fewer than 85 patients, all tended by the knights themselves. With their hospital completed, they returned to their other preferred occupation. Now at last, they could resume their continuing war against the infidel, with its avowed object of reducing to silence the enemies of Christ. Like all the early Ottoman sultans, Suleiman was a pious Muslim, so that after his accession, it was only a question of time before he turned his attention to the knights, whose island fortress lay at his very doorstep, 10 miles off the Anatolian coast. They were comparatively few, with neither an army nor a navy that was any match for his own. But, as his great-grandfather Sultan Mehmet had discovered to his cost, they were by no means easy to dislodge. In 1480, Mehmet had led an army of some 70,000 against them, carried in a fleet of about 50 ships. Also on board there had been a number of those formidable cannon that had smashed the walls of Constantinople 27 years before. Against this huge host, the knights had opposed some 600 members of their order, together with perhaps 1,500 paid foreign troops and local militia. After the first 3 weeks of the siege, the walls began to crumble, and their Grand Master was seriously wounded, but somehow the defenders held firm. Then, suddenly, panic spread through the Turkish lines. The Bashi Bazouks, irregular and largely undisciplined Turkish troops, who fought for plunder rather than pay, turned and fled, the rest of the army behind them. Why this occurred remains a mystery, but whatever the reason, the Turks' triumph was transformed from one moment to the next into disaster. The furious Sultan had immediately begun preparing a fresh army, but in the spring of 1481, as he was riding through Asia Minor to take command, he was struck by a violent attack of dysentery. A day or two later, he was dead. Thus, for 40 years, one of Mehmet's few defeats had remained unavenged. During those years, the knights had worked unceasingly on their defences, building huge angled towers that would permit covering fire along exposed sections of the walls and strengthening the ramparts against the heavy cannon by which they had been so nearly defeated in 1480. Their Grand Master, Philippe Villiers de l'Isle Adam, a deeply pious French nobleman of 57 who had spent most of his life in Rhodes, had received, within a week or two of assuming office in 1521, a letter from the Sultan. In it, Suleiman had boasted of the conquests he had already made, including those of Belgrade and many other fine and well-fortified cities, of which I killed most of the inhabitants and reduced the rest to slavery. Its implications were all too clear, but de l'Isle Adam refused to be intimidated. In his reply, he proudly reported his own recent victory over Kortoglu, a well-known Turkish pirate who had tried unsuccessfully to capture him on his return to Rhodes. Then, in the early summer of 1522, there came another letter. To the Knights of Rhodes, the monstrous injuries that you have inflicted upon my most long-suffering people have aroused my pity and my wrath. I command you therefore instantly to surrender the island and fortress of Rhodes, and I give you my gracious permission to depart in safety with your most valued possessions. If you are wise, you will prefer friendship and peace to the cruelties of war. Any knights who wished, the letter continued, might remain on the island without paying homage or tribute, provided only that they acknowledged the sovereignty of the Sultan. To this second letter the Grand Master returned no answer. On the 26th of June 1522, the first ships of the 700-strong Ottoman fleet appeared on the northern horizon. More and more were to join this vanguard over the next 2 days, including the flagship carrying Suleiman himself, his Grand Vizier Ibrahim and his brother-in-law Mustafa Pasha, who had marched down with the army through Asia Minor. Such was its size, we are told that it was not far short of 200,000, that it took over a month to disembark and assemble. An overwhelming force, it might be thought, when measured against some 700 knights, even after their numbers had been swollen by contingents from the various commanderies of the order throughout Europe, by 500 Cretan archers, by some 1,500 other mercenaries, and, of course, by the Christian people of Rhodes, determined to defend their homes and families. On the other hand, the city's defences were so strong as to be thought by many to be literally impregnable, and the knights had spent the previous year laying in sufficient supplies of food, water and munitions to hold out for many months. In this type of warfare, moreover, life was always a good deal harder for the besiegers than for the besieged, since they had little protection either from the sweltering summer sun or from the cold and rain of winter. For the defenders, forced as they were into a passive role, the principal strain was psychological. Fortunately, however, there was endless work to keep them occupied. They had to maintain a constant vigil over every foot of the wall, repairing damage as soon as it was inflicted, and watching for any sign among the enemy below that might suggest the activity of sappers. Mining had become something of a speciality with the Ottoman armies, who well understood that many an impressive fortification was a good deal more vulnerable from beneath than from the front. By the end of the month, the heavy bombardment had begun in earnest, the cannon being even more powerful than those used in the earlier siege, capable of hurling cannonballs almost 3 feet in diameter, a mile or more. The Turkish army was now drawn up in a huge crescent to the south of the city. That of the knights was divided among their 8 tongues. These were essentially national divisions, those of Aragon, Auvergne, Castile, England, France, Germany, Italy, and Provence, each of which was responsible for the defence of its own section of the wall. By mid-September their worst fears were realised. They had found no fewer than some 50 tunnels, all the work of Turkish sappers, running in various directions under the wall. Fortunately, they had been able to secure the services of the greatest military engineer of his day, an Italian named Gabriele Tadini. Tadini had constructed his own warren of tunnels from which he could listen, with the aid of tightly stretched drums of parchment capable of picking up every blow of a Turkish spade, and frequently deactivate the enemy fuses. But he could not hope to succeed every time, and early in September a mine exploded under the English section, creating a gap in the wall over 30 feet across. The Turks poured in, and there followed 2 hours of bitter hand-to-hand fighting before the defenders somehow prevailed, and the exhausted survivors retired again to their camp. By December, however, the knights were at the end of their tether. Well over half their fighting force was now either dead or hopelessly disabled. Although the Sultan was still offering honourable terms, for a long time the Grand Master kept his resolve. Rather than surrender to the infidel, he argued, every last knight must perish in the ruins of the citadel. It was the native Rhodiots who finally persuaded him that if he continued to resist, the result could only be a massacre of knights and people alike. And so at last Delil Adam sent a message to the Sultan, inviting him personally into the city to discuss terms, and Suleiman accepted. It is said that as he approached the gates he dismissed his bodyguard with the words, "My safety is assured by the word of the Grand Master of the Hospitallers, which is more sure than all the armies of the world." Negotiations were protracted. It was finally agreed that the order would leave Rhodes within 12 days, leaving 50 hostages, 25 knights and 25 islanders. Meanwhile, the Turkish army would retreat a mile from the town. For 5 years, the local population would be exempt from taxes and from the divsirmi, the conscription of Christian children into the imperial Ottoman service. Suleiman also promised that the city would be spared. But somehow a group of Janissaries managed to force their way in and, despite their legendary discipline in battle, to show just how impious and barbaric they could be. "They proceeded," wrote an eyewitness, "to the great church of St. John, where they defaced the frescoes, broke up the tombs of the Grand Masters, scattered the ashes of the dead, dragged the crucifix in the dust, and turned the altars upside down." And all this, he adds, occurred on Christmas morning. On the following day the Grand Master made his formal submission. Suleiman is said to have treated him with all the respect he deserved, congratulating him and his men on their tenacity and courage. It was the fate of princes, he said, to lose towns and provinces from time to time. A week later, on the evening of the 1st of January 1523, the survivors of one of the great sieges of history sailed for Crete. It is reported that the Sultan, as he watched them depart, turned to Ibrahim Pasha. "It saddens me," he murmured, to force that brave old man to leave his home. Nor was it easy for the knights to find another. After Crete they tried Messina, then Viterbo, and finally Nice, but all without success. Then in 1530 the Emperor Charles offered them Malta, with its neighbouring island of Gozo, and, as an additional bonus, the city of Tripoli on the North African coast. The fee was a single falcon, the Maltese falcon, payable every year on All Souls' Day. The knights accepted with alacrity and started work at once on their new hospital. Malta was to be their home for the next 268 years. But, as we shall see, they had not heard the last of the Sultan. 3. All is lost save honour. For the past 5 or 6 years, King Henry had been badgering Rome for a special title to match those of his fellow monarchs, the most Catholic king of Spain and the most Christian king of France, and Rome was not averse to the idea. As early as 1512, Julius II had been on the point of transferring the schismatic Louis XII's title to Henry, but had ultimately decided against it. Nothing much actually happened until 1521, when a magnificently bound copy of a book that the king had just written, the Assertio Septem Sacramentorum, a refutation of Luther's recent book on the Babylonian captivity, was presented to Leo X. Perhaps surprisingly, Leo was deeply impressed by it. He read it with rapt attention, regularly expressing surprise that such a book could have been written by a king. Henry had doubtless had a good deal of help from his friends, but seems to have written much of it himself. And praised it super sidera, to the skies. No longer could he defer the question of the king's new title, and so fide defensor was decided on, defender of the faith. Theoretically, it was awarded to Henry only, and not to his successors, but in 1543, by Act of Parliament, it was joined in perpetuity to the English crown. The whole thing seems a little incongruous, considering that the faith in question is the Roman Catholic one, which Henry and his successors did remarkably little to defend, apart from James II, but much good did it do him. But its abbreviation, Fid Def, or more often the simple FD, regularly appears on British coinage to this day. In that same year of 1521, to strengthen his hand against Francis in Italy, the Emperor Charles had signed a secret treaty with Pope Leo, as a result of which a combined papal and imperial force had expelled the French from Lombardy, restoring the House of Sforza in Milan and, incidentally, enabling the papacy to regain Parma and Piacenza, lost 6 years before. For Leo, here was a splendid reason for celebration. But in the course of the ensuing banquet, which seems to have been more than usually riotous and to have continued all night, he caught a chill that rapidly turned into a fever, and on the 1st of December he died. As a Renaissance prince he was superb. As Pope he was a disaster. In 7 years he is estimated to have spent some 5 million ducats, and at his death he was well over 800,000 in debt. Such was the state of the treasury that the Vatican did not even buy new candles for his funeral. Those used were leftovers from the obsequies of a cardinal who had died a few days before. Conclaves were well known to be uncomfortable things, but the one that now took place must have been among the worst in history. In the depths of a bitter winter, the Vatican was entirely unheated. Several windows had lost their glass and had to be roughly boarded up, with the result that there was also very little light. Most of those present had spent the greater part of their lives in conditions of extreme luxury. Now they found themselves herded together, shivering in the encircling gloom, with little to eat. Their food was passed to them at a round turning wheel made in the wall, still less to drink, and only the most rudimentary sanitation. On the sixth day, by which time one elderly cardinal had been carried out half dead, the meagre rations were still further reduced. Few better ways, one might have thought, could have been devised to encourage a quick decision. But their eminences found agreement impossible, and the deadlock continued. A few days later, however, a letter arrived from the Emperor Charles V, warmly recommending his erstwhile tutor, a 62-year-old Dutchman from Utrecht named Adrian Florence de Dahl. Hardly anyone in Rome had even heard of him. But there. He had no enemies in the city, and, given his age, was unlikely to last too long. Moreover, after Pope Leo, a compromise candidate with, so far as anyone knew, a spotless reputation might be no bad thing. And did not a vote for him represent the best chance of escaping from a freezing Vatican back to their own warm palaces? Thus it came about that on the 9th of January, 1522, after 14 nightmare days of conclave, Pope Adrian VI, he made no attempt to adopt a papal name, was elected Vicar of Christ on Earth. Having travelled by sea, he arrived in Rome only in the following August. He spoke no Italian, his Latin was incomprehensible, and before the end of the year he had antagonized everyone. The populace, who considered him a northern barbarian, the Curia, who were furious at his refusal to distribute the usual benefices, Charles V, who had expected him to join his league against Francis I, and Francis himself, when the Pope arrested and imprisoned one of his cardinals for secretly plotting to hand over Naples to the French. Meanwhile, Adrian lived like a monk. Gone were the courtesans, the catamites, and the banquets with which the Renaissance papacy had made so free. Adrian spent precisely 1 crown a day on catering and employed as domestic staff only his old Flemish housekeeper, who did all his cooking, washing and cleaning. For the art and architecture of the Renaissance he cared not a jot. He threatened to have the Sistine Chapel whitewashed and the Laocoon cast into the Tiber. It need hardly be said that his promised reforms all came to nothing. He failed to control the cardinals, who continued to live like fighting cocks, nor could he do anything to check the sale of indulgences, without which the church would have faced bankruptcy. All his initiatives ended in disaster. His attempts to form a European coalition against the Sultan, his handling of the Reformation, whose importance he consistently failed to recognize, just as Pope Leo had before him, even his proposal, after the expulsion of the knights from Rhodes, for a 3-year truce over the whole of Christendom. When he fell sick and died in September 1523, little more than a year after his arrival in Rome, there was nothing but relief all round. It was another 4.5 centuries before the election of the next non-Italian pope. That relief was tempered, however, by the grim prospect of another conclave. Fortunately, it opened in autumn rather than winter, but it proved even worse in the end. This time it was only after 50 days that the cardinals finally made up their minds. Their final choice fell on Pope Leo's cousin, Giulio de' Medici, who took the name of Clement VII. Leo was the son of Lorenzo the Magnificent, Clement the bastard son of Lorenzo's brother Giuliano, who had been assassinated by the Pazzi in Florence in 1478. The two could hardly have been more different. Leo had been unusually ugly, with a huge head and a fat red face. On the other hand, he had possessed a charm that many found irresistible. Clement, now 48, was tall and slim. He might have been good-looking, but for his thin, tightly compressed lips, haughty expression, and almost perpetual frown. He was pious, conscientious, industrious, but nobody liked him much. His contemporary, Francesco Guicciardini, went so far as to describe him as somewhat morose and disagreeable, reputed to be avaricious, far from trustworthy, and naturally disinclined to do a kindness. It might reasonably be supposed that such a man, however lacking he might be in the social graces, would prove at least a competent pope. Alas, Clement was nothing of the kind. He was vacillating and irresolute, terrified whenever he was called upon to make a decision. He also turned out to be a good deal less intelligent than had first appeared. He might have made a moderately good major. As a general, he was a disaster. His record speaks for itself. The 11 years of his pontificate saw the worst sack of Rome since the barbarian invasions, the establishment in Germany of Protestantism as a separate religion, and the definitive breakaway of the English Church over Henry VIII's divorce. In the winter of 1522-3, some interesting and intriguing news was brought to King Henry at Greenwich. It concerned Charles, 3rd Duke of Bourbon and Constable of France, a man as grand and at the same time as proud and arrogant, even as the French nobility could produce. He had commanded the vanguard of the French army at Marignano, and had been rewarded by King Francis with the governorship of Milan. Later, he had carried the king's sword at the Field of the Cloth of Gold. But Francis, who was never entirely at ease with him, shortly afterwards relieved him of his military command, transferring it to his own brother-in-law, the Duke of Alençon. For Bourbon, this was quite bad enough, but worse was to come. The year 1521 had seen the death of his wife and second cousin, Suzanne. She too had been born a Bourbon, and had inherited from her father virtually all the immense family estates, which she had bequeathed in her will to her husband. We can therefore easily imagine his reaction when he heard that these estates were now being claimed by the king's mother, Louise of Savoy, on the grounds of proximity and blood, her mother having been the daughter of the first Bourbon Duke, and by Francis himself, who argued that they had escheated to the crown. There was a further complication in that Suzanne had left no children. It was thus essential that the Duke should remarry to preserve the safety of his line. Louise, who had loved him for years, proposed to settle the problem by herself becoming his second wife, but at 44 she was 14 years older than he was, and he not unreasonably turned her down. She, however, took her rejection as an insult, as did Francis. Henceforth, Valois-Bourbon relations could hardly have been worse. And so the Duke turned to Francis's enemies, to the Empire and to England. Secret negotiations were put in train. At the end of June, the English ambassador to the Low Countries was instructed to put on heavy disguise, seek out Bourbon, and offer him terms, and a week or two later a treaty was signed between Henry, Charles and Bourbon, committing all three to a joint invasion of France. The year was dangerously far advanced. Most campaigns began at the first signs of spring, but the opportunity seemed too good to miss. And in August 1523, almost exactly a decade after Henry's first French adventure, the Duke of Suffolk led an army of 10,000 men across the Channel. His principal target was Boulogne, possession of which would greatly facilitate the much more ambitious campaign that was being planned for the following year. Alas, his masters changed their minds. Some 3 weeks after his arrival at Calais, Wolsey, pointing out that there shall never be such or like opportunity given hereafter for the attaining of France, proposed an immediate attack on Paris. King Henry at first objected. The year was too old, the problems of victualling a fast-moving army too great. Francis might swiftly recall his army from Italy, leaving the invaders to face a vastly superior force. But at last he allowed himself to be persuaded, and Suffolk duly ordered his men to march into the heart of France. By the end of October they were only some 50 miles from the capital. Then, suddenly, disaster struck on every side. Bourbon's projected march from Besançon collapsed almost as soon as it had started. Suffolk's Burgundian allies deserted him. An unseasonal cold snap wrought havoc throughout the army, particularly among the horses, and this was followed by a sudden thaw which turned everything to mud, making the heavy guns impossible to move. It was difficult enough even to pitch a tent. There was nothing for it but an ignominious retreat. Meanwhile, Francis formally stripped Bourbon of all his offices and declared him a traitor, which indeed is exactly what he was. King Henry, it need hardly be said, took the news of the disaster very badly indeed. At first he refused absolutely to accept it, demanding that his by now despairing army should return and continue the fight. Finally, he accepted that nothing more could be done during the coming winter, but he insisted it was only a question of reculer pour mieux sauter, step back for a better jump, and at once set about the preparations for a new campaign in the spring. Meanwhile, he dispatched an ambassador, Richard Pace, to conclude a new treaty with Bourbon, who received him warmly and swore an oath of allegiance to Henry. "I promise you on my faith," he declared, "that I will put the crown of France upon the king, our common master's head, or else my days shall be cut off." He followed up with a magnificent advance through Provence to Marseille, but once again he failed to achieve anything permanent. Suddenly, we are not sure why, he abandoned the siege of Marseille and slipped over the border into Italy. Charles and Henry might have been forgiven for thinking that their glamorous new ally possessed feet of clay. The Emperor Charles had concluded a secret treaty with Pope Leo X in 1521, which had committed the Pope fairly and squarely to the imperial side in its struggle with the King of France, and he naturally supposed that Leo's cousin, Clement VII, would respect it. Clement, however, did nothing of the kind. Instead, he tried to make peace between the two parties, an attempt that failed utterly, just as everyone had told him it would. Charles would yield Milan only in return for Burgundy. Francis, meanwhile, was as determined as ever to launch a new Italian campaign, on which, in the absence of any clear papal opposition, the way was now clear for him to go ahead. And in the summer of 1524, with an army of some 20,000, he marched back over the Mont-Cenis Pass into Italy. In late October 1524, he recaptured Milan. He then turned south to Pavia. This city proved a tougher nut to crack than he had expected. Its garrison of 6,000 Germans and Spaniards made it clear at the start that they proposed to give as good as they got. At one moment he even tried to divert the Ticino River, which washes the walls on the southern side, but his dam was swept away by torrential rains. His most sensible course would have been to retire to Milan for the winter. But no. Never, he somewhat absurdly claimed, had a French king besieged a city or town without taking it. He would maintain the siege until the defenders starved, which, however, they seemed in no hurry to do. He and his men suffered an extremely cold and uncomfortable winter as a result, and they were still there in late February, when an imperial army appeared on the horizon, led not, as might have been expected, by an Austrian or a Spaniard, but by his former friend and now his arch-enemy, Charles, Duke of Bourbon. The two armies met in the great hunting preserve of Mirabello Castle, just outside the walls of Pavia. And on the morning of Tuesday, the 24th of February, 1525, it happened to be the Emperor's 25th birthday, battle was joined. The ensuing engagement proved to be one of the most decisive in European history. It was also, perhaps, the first to prove conclusively the superiority of firearms over pikes. The Swiss pikemen, who were this time fighting for Francis, struggled valiantly, but their weapons, fearsome as they were no match for Spanish bullets. When the fighting was over, the French army had been virtually annihilated. Some 14,000 soldiers, French and Swiss, German and Spanish, lay dead on the field. Francis himself had shown, as always, exemplary courage. After his horse had been killed under him, he had continued to fight on foot, until at last, overcome by exhaustion, he had allowed himself to be captured. "All is lost," he wrote to his mother, "save honour and my skin." The king's capture was largely due to a brilliantly executed attack by the Spanish general Fernando Francisco Avalos, Marquis of Pescara. We should have heard much more of him had he not died that December, his death having been caused, according to the contemporary historian Paolo Giovio, by his reckless habit of drinking water. Having sustained nothing more than a bruised leg and a scratched hand and cheek, he was indeed lucky to be alive. The best estimates suggest that of the 1,400-odd French men-at-arms on the field, not more than 400 survived. Francis was taken first to the castle of Pizzighettone on the Adda River, where he remained for some 3 months. The news of his capture was received by his fellow monarchs in widely differing ways. Charles, we are told, to whom the news was brought on the 10th of March in Madrid, ordered services of thanksgiving and then withdrew to pray alone. He also sent instructions to the Viceroy of Naples to take good care of his prisoner and to send regular reports to the king's mother. Henry, on the other hand, to whom the news was delivered on the previous day, leapt from his bed, pulled on some clothes, gave a shout of joy, and then fell on his knees to give his own thanks. "All the enemies of England," he declared, "are now gone." He then called for wine and invited the messenger, whom he had improbably compared to the Archangel Gabriel at the Annunciation, to celebrate with him. Beacons blazed over England, and Wolsey sang a special celebratory high mass in St. Paul's. But celebration was not enough. Now was the time for what Henry called the great enterprise, for Charles and himself, assisted by the Duke of Bourbon, to invade France and partition it between them. Not a moment was to be lost. An embassy was immediately sent to Spain to plan the details. Francis's capture was divine punishment for his high orgul, his pride and his insatiable ambition. There must be no question, Henry suggested, of the king's ransom or restoration, even to a reduced kingdom. Rather, let his whole line and succession be abolished, removed and utterly extinct. The two allied forces must now march on Paris, where Henry would be crowned King of France by just title of inheritance. He and Charles would then march together to Italy, where he would assist Charles in the recovery of his rights and even witness his final coronation in Rome. Alas, he was in for a serious disappointment. Charles, desperately short of money, was in no mood to redraw the map of Europe. Henry's ambassadors, who returned to England with Charles's reply, were not inclined to mince matters. The emperor, they reported, intended little or nothing to your commodity, profit or benefit. And there was worse to come. In April there arrived in London a special ambassador from the emperor, the knight commander Peñalosa, to say that unless the Princess Mary could be sent at once to Spain, with a substantial part of her dowry in ready money, his master must ask the king to release him from the engagement so that he would be free to marry another cousin, King Manuel, the first of Portugal's daughter Isabella. He doubtless refrained from adding that Isabella would be bringing with her 900,000 golden ducats in cash. He was keen to marry sooner rather than later, since he was anxious to return to northern Europe and wanted to leave an empress ruling in Spain. For Henry, this was betrayal. He had been genuinely fond of Charles, had helped him, advised him, lent him money. He and Catherine had looked forward to the day when he would be not only their nephew, but their son-in-law as well. Now there was nothing he could do but reply that he expected the immediate repayment of all the emperor's debts to him, and that he considered all treaties between them to be null and void. Wolsey, meanwhile, was instructed to conclude, as a matter of urgency, a separate peace with France. It may have been part of his anger and frustration that induced Henry to turn on his wife. The two of them had now been married 16 years. Their first passion, if passion it had been, had long since burned itself out, and Catherine's continued failure to produce a son had not improved their relationship. Henry's son, by her lady-in-waiting Bessie Blunt, little Henry Fitzroy, had meanwhile attained the age of 6, and, perhaps because he saw him as a possible future monarch, his father decided to bring him into the public eye. On the 18th of June, 1525, the boy was brought down the river to Henry's recently built Bridewell Palace at Blackfriars. There, in the presence of the entire court and much of the nobility of England, he was first knighted, then granted a peerage. Finally, he rose from his knees to be acclaimed Duke of Richmond and Somerset. By evening, he was also Lord Admiral of England, Wales and Ireland, of Normandy, Gascony and Aquitaine, Knight of the Garter, Keeper of the City and Castle of Carlisle, and Prime Peer of England. It was the first time since the 12th century that a King of England had ennobled a bastard son. The first occasion had been in 1188, when Henry II made his son, William Longespay, Earl of Salisbury. The feelings of Catherine, who had been obliged to witness all these successive ceremonies, may well be imagined. Here was a deliberate insult, both to herself and to her daughter, and one that she did not propose to take lying down. She protested to her husband, to Wolsey, to all with whom she came in contact, but her protests were ignored. Soon afterwards, without any advance consultation, Wolsey summarily dismissed several of her waiting women on the grounds that they had encouraged her outburst. And even that was not all. Henry now ordered his daughter, the little Princess Mary, now 9 years old, to take up residence in the castle of Ludlow, 150 miles from London, a good week's journey, there to assume her responsibilities as Princess of Wales. Her mother, who had brought her up, educated her, and had seldom left her side, was expressly forbidden to accompany her. There was one single crumb of comfort. Mary was still Princess of Wales. Where the succession was concerned, Henry's mind was clearly still not made up. Francis remained at Pizzighettone till May. After that, he had been destined for a prison in Naples, but the prospect was so unpleasant that he begged the imperial viceroy, Charles de Lannoy, to send him instead to Spain. Lannoy agreed, and so it was to Spain that the captive king sailed from Genoa on the 31st. He arrived in Barcelona to find a letter from the emperor, whom, surprisingly, Lannoy had not bothered to inform of his decision. Charles was in Madrid, and had first learned of it only by chance. He showed, however, no sign of anger, being content to welcome the king to Spain and to express the hope that peace would be the result. Thenceforward, from the very moment of his arrival until he reached Madrid, Francis found himself treated like the king he was. In Barcelona he attended mass at the cathedral and even touched for the king's evil. At Valencia he was so mobbed by the populace that the Spanish captain responsible for his safety, Fernando de Alarcón, had to remove him to a comfortable villa outside the town. The last stage of his journey to Madrid was more than ever like a royal progress. There were banquets, there were bullfights, there were visits to hospitals and universities, but a bitter disappointment awaited him in Madrid. On his arrival in the capital on the 11th of August, he was given lodging in the Tower of the Alcazar, standing on the site of the present royal palace. It was destroyed by fire in 1734. The Duc de Saint-Simon, who visited it 2 centuries later, describes it in his memoirs. The room was not big, and had only one door, through which one entered. It was made a little larger by an embrasure on the right as one came in, facing the window. The latter was wide enough to give some daylight, it was glazed and could be opened, but it had a double iron grille, strong and stiff, which was welded into the wall. There was enough room for chairs, coffers, a few tables, and a bed. From the window, the Duke added, there was a drop of more than 100 feet, and the tower was guarded day and night by 2 companies of troops. Here Francis, having made one unsuccessful attempt to escape, disguised as a black servant, was made to wait, his only exercise the occasional mule ride under heavy escort, while preparations were begun for the peace talks, which could clearly not be very long delayed. The decisiveness of the Emperor's victory had sent a tremor through the entire Italian peninsula, where peace, even comparative peace, depended on the balance of power. But Italy was not Charles's main anxiety. The fact was that, for all their mutual hostility, he needed Francis. However insuperable their differences, the two must combine their forces, not only against Martin Luther, but now also against Suleiman. Where, Charles was wondering, would the dread Sultan strike next? There was no doubt that he would continue his advance against the forces of Christendom. How could he be halted except by concerted crusade, led by Charles himself and backed by all the Christian powers? But how, in the prevailing circumstances, could Francis be persuaded to lend his support to such an effort? How, in short, was such a crusade to be launched while Europe was so bitterly and brutally divided against itself? The peace talks, which were attended on the French side by both Francis's mother, Louise of Savoy, now regent, and by his sister, Margaret of Alençon, began in Toledo in July 1525, unpromisingly enough, with Burgundy remaining as always the principal bone of contention. They were still dragging on by the 11th of September, on which day, however, Francis suddenly fell ill, so ill indeed that his life was despaired of. For 23 days he lay inert, and for most of the time unconscious. The Emperor, who till now had shown no desire to meet his fellow monarch, came hurrying to his bedside. It was their first meeting. According to the doctors, the root of the trouble was an abscess in the head. But 16th-century diagnoses were far from reliable, and we shall never know. In any event, the king suddenly began to recover, and as soon as he was well enough, he was moved to the capital, where the negotiations continued until he declared himself ready to agree to the proposed treaty. The first thing to be said about the Treaty of Madrid, which a convalescent Francis signed on the 14th of January 1526, was that he had not the faintest intention of observing it, despite the fact that he was prepared to leave his two sons as hostages for his good behaviour. He had even taken the precaution of signing another secret declaration, nullifying the surrender of Burgundy as having been extracted from him by force. How otherwise could he so readily have renounced all his long-held claims, not only to Burgundy, but also to Naples and even to Milan? He also, incidentally, restored all the disputed lands to the Duke of Bourbon, on condition that we never see him again. But the restoration never took place in the Duke's lifetime. He was still far from well. On Sunday, the 29th of January, he had to be carried to church on a litter. But he returned riding on a mule, and the next day he was well enough to attend a luncheon given in his honour. Afterwards, we are told, he visited a convent, where he touched 30 scrofulous nuns. On the 13th of February, Charles V joined him in Madrid. It had been arranged as part of the treaty that Francis should marry Charles's sister Eleanor, widow of King Manuel I of Portugal, and the Emperor now introduced the pair for the first time. She tried to kiss his hand, but he, not uncharacteristically, insisted, as her husband, on a proper kiss on the mouth. Next day, she performed a Spanish dance for his benefit. The day after, the two sovereigns separated, Charles to Lisbon, there to marry his own Portuguese princess, King Manuel's daughter Isabella, Francis to return to Paris, whither it was arranged that his new bride should follow him in due course. But there was one unhappy little ceremony to be completed before he did so. It occurred on the little river Bidassoa, which constituted, as it still does, part of the frontier between France and Spain. There was no bridge, it could be crossed only by boat. Early on the morning of the 17th of March, 1526, two rowing boats made their way to a pontoon in midstream. One carried the king, the viceroy of Naples, and Alençon. The other, two little boys, the 8-year-old Dauphin and his brother, Henry, Duke of Orléans, aged 7. Both of them still recovering from serious attacks of measles, they were on their way to Spain for an indefinite period as hostages for their father's good behaviour. When the two boats reached the pontoon, they changed passengers, while a tearful Francis made the sign of the cross over his children and promised, with how much hope one wonders, to send for them as soon as he could. The exchange completed, the boats then returned to their original moorings. Henry VIII had welcomed the news of Francis's capture at Pavia. That of his capitulation in Madrid caused a very different reaction in London. Cardinal Wolsey simply could not believe what he was being told. Imagine if Charles should recover Burgundy while his sister Eleanor was Queen of France. And what was to happen if Charles and his brother Ferdinand died without legitimate issue? Their whole inheritance would devolve upon their sister and her husband, Francis. The future of Europe looked perilous indeed. Francis, on the other hand, spent a delightful summer riding gently through his realm, and arrived in Paris only in the autumn, by which time some of the initial indignation at the terms of the Treaty of Madrid had begun to die down, though the estates of Burgundy were still vociferously protesting that the king had no right to alienate a province of the kingdom without the consent of its people. Francis replied, quite simply, that he had no intention of doing so. It was surely well known that promises extorted in prison had no binding force. He had no wish to antagonize Charles more than he had to. Apart from anything else, he wanted to recover his sons. At the same time, the balance of power had become seriously upset. The emperor was once again too powerful, and it was plain that something must be done to cut him back to size. As for Pope Clement, he was aghast. Without a French presence anywhere in Italy, how could he hope to defend himself against imperial pressure? Hastily he recruited Milan, Venice, and Florence to form an anti-imperialist league for the defense of a free and independent Italy, and invited France to join. Though the ink was scarcely dry on the Treaty of Madrid, and though he and the Pope held widely differing views on Milan, the Pope favoring the Sforzas while Francis still wanted the city for himself, on the 22nd of May, 1526, the king, with his usual flourish, signed his name to what was to be called the League of Cognac. It meant, he knew, that it would be a long time, perhaps another 3 or 4 years, unless he could persuade Charles to accept a cash ransom, before he saw his sons again. But there, they would be well looked after. They would also learn Spanish and make a number of contacts which might be of considerable use to them in the future. For Charles this was, of course, nothing less than a betrayal. There could now be no question of a ransom, if indeed there ever had been. Francis's breach of faith had horrified him, and shocked him deeply. Crowned heads simply could not behave so shamelessly. He had been planning to go to Italy for his coronation by the Pope. Now that journey would clearly have to be indefinitely postponed. "He is full of dumps," reported an English envoy, "and solitary, musing sometimes alone 3 or 4 hours together. There is no mirth or comfort with him." To the French ambassador he did not conceal his anger. "I will not deliver them," the two little princes, "for money. I refused money for the father, still less will I take money for the sons. I am content to render them upon reasonable treaty, but not for money, nor will I trust any more the king's promise, for he has deceived me, and that like no noble prince. And where he excuses that he cannot fulfil some things without grudge of his subjects, let him fulfil that is in his power, which he promised by the honour of a prince to fulfil. That is to say, that if he could not bring all his promise to pass, he would return again hither into prison." The League of Cognac, which King Henry warmly encouraged but was careful not to join, introduced an exciting new concept into Italian affairs. For perhaps the first time, here was an agreement dedicated to the proposition that Milan, and so by extension all the other Italian states, should be free of foreign domination. Liberty was the watchword. Clearly there could not yet be liberty for Italy as a whole, since Italy was still no more than a geographical expression. At the same time, it was clear to all the Italian signatories of the League that the only hope of resistance to the power of Charles V, or Francis I, come to that, lay in a settlement of their own internal differences, a pooling of their resources, and the presentation of a firmly united front to any would-be invader. The Risorgimento was still more than 3 centuries away, but here, perhaps, were the first glimmerings of the national sentiment that gave it birth. Francis, however, still felt threatened. Charles and his brother Ferdinand seemed determined to control the whole of Europe, while his own kingdom was already surrounded by potentially hostile territory. If it were to survive unconquered, its best hope lay in finding a new ally in the east, and that could only be the Ottoman Sultan. The first French diplomatic mission to Suleiman set out early in 1525, immediately after Pavia, on the orders of the Queen Mother, even before the king's return from captivity. The name of its leader has not come down to us. We do know, however, that he carried many precious gifts, too precious, as it happened, because he and his entire suite were set upon and killed en route by the Pasha of Bosnia, who seized all their treasures for himself. When Francis, now released, heard of the disaster, he seems to have accepted it philosophically. He immediately ordered another mission, this time led by John Frangipani, a Croatian nobleman in the French service who, if the Pasha remained in a murderous mood, would at least be able to remonstrate with him in his own language. In fact, Frangipani, who carried a letter from his master hidden in the sole of his boot, was to arrive in December safely in Istanbul, where he received the warmest of welcomes. The penitent Pasha was summoned to the Sublime Porte and obliged to return all that he had stolen, while Suleiman readily agreed, though without making any definite promises, that he and his new French friends should spare no efforts to ensure that the emperor should not become the ruler of the world. Frangipani also had a number of minor requests, all of which the Sultan instantly granted, except for a church in Jerusalem, which had been converted into a mosque, and which he declined to restore to its original purpose. The laws of Islam, it was politely explained, did not permit a mosque to change its function, but even this pill was carefully sugared. The places other than the mosque will remain in Christian hands. No one will molest those who remain there during our just reign. They will live in tranquility under the wing of our protection. They may retain in complete security all the oratories and other buildings which they occupy at present, without anyone being permitted to oppress them or to torment them in any way. By establishing such friendly relations with the Porte, Francis doubtless improved the lot of Christians in the East. But he never lost sight of his primary object, to enlist Ottoman help against Charles. His negotiations with the Sultan were by now common knowledge throughout Europe. As Thomas Cromwell once remarked, no Christian scruple would deter the King of France from bringing the Turk and the devil into the heart of Christendom if this could help him recover Milan. Francis himself admitted as much. I cannot deny that I keenly desire the Turk powerful and ready for war, not for himself, because he is an infidel and we are Christians, but to undermine the emperor's power, to force heavy expenses upon him, and to reassure all other governments against so powerful an enemy. To his enemies, the most Christian king had now become the executioner of Christendom. If, as was widely rumoured, the Turks were planning another campaign along the Danube, the French were sure to be behind it. Francis thus found himself on a tightrope. He was obliged to convince Europe of his utter loyalty to the Christian cause. At the same time, it was vital to keep the Sultan reassured, and to persuade him that such public statements as he was obliged to make from time to time were of no real significance. He was aware, too, that he needed Suleiman far more than Suleiman needed him. Without the Sultan's help, what chance had he of resisting the immense power of the empire, which hemmed him in both to the east and to the west? And how else, finally, could he ever achieve the old Valois dream of ruling Italy? Frangipani's mission was a success as far as it went, but by then Suleiman had other things on his mind. For one thing, he had unfinished business in Hungary. The time had now come to return to the charge, and so it was that on Monday, 21st of April, 1526, he and Ibrahim Pasha, by now his Grand Vizier, led another huge army out of Istanbul's Adrianople Gate and headed west. Their route was familiar enough, passing once again through Sofia and Belgrade, and thence along the Danube to Buda. The weather was dreadful. Suleiman was unlucky with it all his life. The rivers were swollen, many bridges had been swept away, and the roads, such as they were, consisted for the most part of thick, deep mud, which made the cannon almost impossible to move. Yet somehow the army managed to advance, with the Sultan always maintaining the iron discipline for which he was famous. Soldiers who trampled on sown fields or failed to respect the townspeople and villagers as they passed were executed on the spot. When they reached the town of Osijek, they were obliged to build a bridge over the Drava River. 332 meters long, it was completed in 5 days. The moment the last soldier had crossed it, it was destroyed. Retreat was never an option. At last they reached the Mohacs plain, some 15 miles from the confluence of the Drava and the Danube, where King Louis, the emperor's brother-in-law, was waiting for them. For Louis the situation was grave indeed. His country was deeply divided, many of the peasants living in such misery that they were prepared to welcome the Turks as liberators. Meanwhile, an ambitious nobleman named John Zapolya had his eye on the crown, and most of his fellow boyars had no interest at all in strengthening the king's position or that of the Habsburgs. The Germans, indeed, they detested to the point where they demanded their expulsion, at the very time when the country needed all the help it could get. Louis had done his utmost to find support elsewhere in Europe. "If assistance from your Majesty does not arrive soon," he wrote to Henry in England, "my kingdom is lost. Henry, it need hardly be said, did not lift a finger. Charles V was equally disobliging. He was in Spain anyway, and had other problems on his mind. In any case, matters such as this were the responsibility of his brother. Why else had he split the empire? In his desperation, Louis had even begged the Shah of Persia to create a diversion in the east, but had received no reply. As a last resort, he had appealed to the Diet of German princes, but they made any help conditional on the calling of a general council to settle their religious problems. After long discussions and in return for a promise that such a council would indeed be held in 18 months' time, they agreed to send 24,000 men. But by then it was too late. The Battle of Mohács had been fought and lost. On the Hungarian side, Mohács provided the perfect illustration of how not to fight a battle. To begin with, none of Louis's boyars heeded his call to the colours. He had summoned them to assemble on the 2nd of July, but on the appointed day not one of them showed up. Nor, incidentally, did Louis himself. It was only after his arrival a day or two later that the army began to form. Those members of the nobility who were prepared to fight at all pressed the king to engage the enemy at once, without even waiting for the armies of John Zapolya or the Croatian Count Krzysztof Frankopan, perhaps another 30,000 to 40,000 men in all, which were only a few days' march away. The supreme command had for some reason been given to a Roman Catholic monk, Archbishop Paul Tomori of Kalocsa, whose astonishing overconfidence was probably due to his blind belief in the Hungarian cavalry, of which both horses and riders were so completely encased in armour that they were practically unable to move when their lightly armed Turkish counterparts slipped in and out and methodically destroyed them. The archbishop had forgotten too, if indeed he had ever understood, the power of the Turkish artillery with its huge cannon, firing cannonballs of iron that exploded on impact. The battle began at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and probably ended at around 6. During much of that time it was pelting with rain. Both sides fought with conspicuous bravery, and the Sultan, always in the thick of the fray, narrowly escaped with his life. Several of his bodyguards were killed, and he himself survived only when a body of his own Janissaries surrounded him and hamstrung the horses of his assailants. And few were braver than the archbishop. In the unimprovable words of Kemal Pashazadeh, a Turkish historian, "Like cast iron, the more the battle struck him, the more he steeped himself in it and drew strength from it. Like a viper or an elephant, he held his own against the claws of combat or the stones cast in battle. Covered with wounds, like a mad dog, he recovered himself. When he rushed into the attack, impetuous as the Nile, he uttered screams like the trumpeting of elephants when tigers and lions flee before them." Unable or unwilling to follow their leader's example, most of his compatriots fled for their lives. King Louis left the field as dark was falling, but was thrown from his horse while crossing a river. The weight of his armour did the rest. Among the 15,000 who died with him were most of the Hungarian nobility. Until midnight, we are told, the Turkish fanfares rang out in honour of the victory. The next morning, Suleiman, seated on a golden throne in a scarlet tent, received congratulations and distributed rewards. Before him was a pyramid of 2,000 human heads, including those of 7 Hungarian bishops. Summoning his grand vizier to his side, he personally pinned to his turban a heron's feather decorated with diamonds, whose shadow covered him like the wing of felicity. The Battle of Mohács effectively put an end to Hungary as a single independent state for generations to come. All Western Europe was horrified, but also conscious of its collective failure, a repetition of that which had lost Constantinople 73 years before. Despite increasingly desperate appeals from King Louis, no one had come to his aid. The country never entirely recovered, and its most memorable defeat entered its folklore. An old Hungarian song tells of a series of domestic disasters. After each comes the chorus, "Tobis verset Mohács nál." But no matter, more was lost on Mohács field. In modern Hungarian, the line has become a proverb. It was a few months before Mohács, in March 1526, that the Emperor Charles, all thoughts of his English princess forgotten, married his first cousin Isabella, daughter of King Manuel I of Portugal, in the Alcázar in Seville. She had been named after her maternal grandmother, Queen Isabella of Castile. It had started as a purely political union. Charles simply needed a member of his dynasty to govern Spain, Castile and Aragon during his long absences, and the couple had never seen each other before they met to be married. but it turned rapidly into a love match. An eyewitness noted that during what passed for their honeymoon, when they are together, although there are many people around, they do not notice anyone else. They talk and laugh, and nothing else distracts them. On the 21st of May, 1527, Isabella gave birth to a son, the future Philip II, which her husband celebrated as a Spaniard should, with a corrida. We are told that he himself stepped forward as matador, killing the bull by his own hand. Two more of Isabella's children, Maria and Juana, grew to adulthood. She herself remained all her life in Spain, spending with her husband little more than half their 13 years of marriage. But the emperor, despite his long absences, loved her dearly, and seems to have remained faithful to her until her death. That death, however, was to come all too soon. The lovely empress died, after her 6th pregnancy, in 1536 at the age of only 33, and it broke her husband's heart. He never remarried, and was to dress in black for the rest of his life. On the 30th of August, 1525, King Henry VIII had signed a treaty of peace with France. He had done so much against his will. He would greatly have preferred to take advantage of the French king's captivity to invade the country and conquer what he could, had he only been able to do so. But it was not only Charles's lack of enthusiasm that had prevented him. There was also a problem of finance. The cost of such an operation had been estimated at £800,000, and Parliament had put its foot down. The king's earlier adventures in France had not been particularly profitable. It had no intention of financing any more of them. Cardinal Wolsey had therefore tried an alternative with what he called an amicable grant, in fact a levy of 1/3 of the goods of the clergy and between 1/6 and 1/10 of those of the laity. The result had been far from amicable. There were furious demonstrations up and down the country, and in many places an outright refusal to contribute. At Lavenham in Suffolk, 10,000 men planned to converge in active protest. It was said that they failed only because the clappers had been removed from the church bells that were to signal the start of the uprising. Wolsey was on shaky ground, and he knew it. With no parliamentary authority for his scheme, he had no course but to abandon the idea, a humiliating climb down which may well have indirectly contributed to his fall 4 years later, since it was the first occasion on which he had significantly failed to do his master's will. It was at this point, in an attempt to strengthen his position, that he made the king a present of Hampton Court, though from all that we know of Henry we can be sure that, however grateful he may have been, the frustration of his French ambitions would have continued to rankle. For the moment, however, peace it would have to be, and in April 1527, with Francis back again in Paris after his captivity, and the situation looking very different from what it had been 2 years before, that peace was converted into an alliance, which was ratified when Wolsey met Francis at Amiens the following August. Soon afterwards, England and France declared war on the Empire, but Charles had too much else on his plate, and seems to have taken little notice. Henry, too, had other preoccupations. He had come to the conclusion that he must leave his wife. He dreaded breaking the news to her, and put the evil day off as long as he could. But one day, in the high summer of 1527, he sought out Catherine in her closet. He had been advised, he told her, that their marriage was invalid. For the past 18 years they had been living in sin. The book of Leviticus 20:21 made it all too clear. And if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He hath uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. The king was less inclined to quote Deuteronomy 25:5, her husband's brother shall go in unto her, and take her to him to wife. He and Catherine had no choice but to separate at once, while he sought an official annulment from the Pope. Meanwhile, of course, he had every desire that she should continue to live in comfort. Where, precisely, would she like to go? For a long time Catherine stared at him in silence. Then she burst into a flood of tears. They were tears, however, not of sorrow, but of anger. Anger that she should be condemned as an adulteress, anger that her daughter was being declared a bastard, but anger, too, at the ridiculous excuse she had been given for the proposed separation. As yet she knew nothing of Anne Boleyn. Taking her husband's words at their face value, she herself had no doubts that her marriage to him had been legitimate. It was the first ceremony, to young Prince Arthur, which had been null and void, simply because it had never been consummated. She had come to Henry a virgin, as he could himself have attested, had he been willing to do so,